Welcome back to episode 192 of Tall Boy Radio. And as we always say, who knows where it goes when the beer flows? Well, I'll tell you where it goes, about a junction down the M6 tonight, as it just so happens. Or should I say up, because we're heading slightly north to Northwich. So before we get to our guest, let's say hello to the two irregulars that have joined us tonight. Gazza?
Yeah, evening all, evening the world. Looking forward to this, as ever. Adam has given a little teaser as to the fact we've got a guest on tonight, and it's always fantastic to have somebody on our podcast that hasn't been on before, although has contributed to a number of previous podcasts via sort of views and comments and this, that, and the other. So looking forward to meeting him, getting to know him, and seeing where it goes.
Indeed, indeed. And now, on to the man with the technical problems, Mr. David. How are we? David from 2013.
Very well, thank you. 2013 was the wrong year, by the way. I realised it's 2008. I had some technical problems, but not with the year, with the microphone.
I'm going to say, boy, you've just missed 5 years, haven't you?
God bless us. He's here. He's sorted. He's still not got his microphone plugged in, but we don't want to trigger him. So before we get any more angst out of Dave, let's go to our guest. And we're going to introduce a gentleman. You'll have seen his name, as Gaz said, across the bottom of the screen. Stuart, do you want to say hello and tell us a little bit about what it is you're going to be talking about tonight?
Well, tonight I'll be talking a little bit about my time as a first responder for North West Ambulance Service.
Indeed, indeed. Mm-hmm. So, as Stuart said there, so as a point of disclosure, Stuart and I used to work together, not in the ambulance service, I might add. My contributions to society are far, far less, I should say. But Stuart, like you say, so you spent a fair amount of time, as we were discussing earlier, in that role as a first responder. Tell us a little bit how you got into that.
Well, I basically saw an advertisement for free first aid courses, which was, you know, back in 2006, I think, roughly. So I thought, well, I wouldn't mind learning a new skill. So I went along to this first aid course, and it was being run by volunteers. These volunteers were community first responders, but they ran the British Heart Foundation Heart Start course, which is a free course that's 2 hours long that's free to the general public. So I thought, well, yeah, I fancy that. So I went along, did the course and everything, and spoke to one of the volunteers and basically asked, you know, what is it you do? You know, because they're all in the green uniform and everything. And like, well, we're community first responders. We're volunteers that work on behalf of the ambulance service and go out to 999 calls when an ambulance could be 10, 20 miles away. And we try and get there first to make a difference, you know, whether it's dealing with somebody who's having a cardiac arrest, whether it's somebody with breathing difficulties, whether it's, you know, somebody that's cut themselves or anything like that, really. Yeah, I thought, I fancy that. I fancy doing something useful for the community. So I signed up, went and did the training course, which was a 13-week training course, which was in Congleton at St. John's. So I ended up doing 13 weeks training, got all the uniform, trained upon all the equipment, got all the qualifications as well to do the role. And then pretty much I was out on the road, thrown in the deep end, because the first shift I did, I ended up getting 12 999 calls back to back, one after another. Wow. And I was all on my own, responding in a car, just going to all these jobs, and it was just job after job after job after job. Crazy.
So on a scale of one to shitting it, how much were you shitting it then on that first call?
Probably about a 6 or a 7.
Okay. Right. And when you got there, how much were you shitting it? When you actually got there, you realised what you were faced with?
Well, it's funny you should mention what you're faced with, because sometimes back then we used to have like these pages, old school, and it was like, you know, you'd get something like, oh, breathing difficulties you'd get to that job and you'd find out, oh, it's not a breathing difficulties job. This person's actually cut their arm open. The reason why they're having breathing difficulties is because they're having a panic attack due to the amount of blood that's gushing out of their arm. So sometimes I sort of went on the perception of the information is only good as it's given.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you turn up to these jobs, it's a case of, you know, what the actual job details are is not actually what you could be dealing with. It could be completely something different. So,
and you're going blind. Are you sort of directed and dispatched via the ambulance dispatch then effectively? So they would get some information to their call centre and they would dispatch you.
It used to go to, I don't think it does anymore because they've moved, but it used to go to this call centre in Liverpool called Elm House. Mm-hmm. Now, Elm House is like a big old country manor house. It was a huge, big white building. So the 999 calls would go to there, to a call handler. Now, the call handlers used to work downstairs in this big house. And then they would take all the information, put it into the computer. Then that computer then passes that information upstairs to a dispatcher. And the dispatcher's like got four great big computer monitors in front of them. And they're constantly looking to see which is the nearest resource or asset we've got that's able to get to that job. And then basically they just click on the cursor and you're it. And that's what happens next. You get sent. So
So I mean, don't throw your old colleagues under the bus though. So when you did that, not literally, obviously as well.
When you did that
13-week course and then they set you out of that. Did you feel prepared to be dealing with the things that you were dealing with then on that first day?
Not everything. I think, you know, the basic stuff, yes. But I mean, the more complex stuff, not really. I think that comes with it more experience over the years.
Yeah. With that 13 weeks, is that like an hour a week, 13 weeks, or is it multiple hours and was it homework?
Multiple hours and plenty of homework. Yeah.
So it was pretty intensive then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I went beyond that because they ended up introducing like an enhanced course as well, which dealt with more like major trauma stuff. And that was 6 months. So that's almost like being a technician. So I had to go back to Liverpool for 6 months and I had to do like 32 exams for that alone. So that was pretty much, you know, online stuff as well as going to classroom lessons with paramedics and they were going, right, okay, this is what this course entails. This is what these practical sessions are going to be about. So they'd stick you in a room and they'd give you any scenario and you would have to deal with that scenario.
In terms of, I'm just curious, if you are being dispatched by the sort of the ambulance call center, whatever it may be, would there be an occasion where they wouldn't call upon you, even though you might be the closest person? Maybe your training might not.
Yeah, there was quite a few of that. So, for example, childbirths were out, so they wouldn't send me to anything like that. Road traffic accidents, they wouldn't send me to them. They were totally out. But everything else was pretty much in. So put it this in this perspective, I was trained to possibly deal with about 400 different types of incident.
All right. Okay.
Wow. Whereas previous, when I did the 13-week course, I was probably only trained to deal with about 150. Right. So when I upped my skill set level, I went higher up with the call set.
Yeah. So effectively, you get bumped up, and depending on what the incident was, they would go down and go, no, he's not qualified. Oh, Stuart is. We'll send him. He's closest.
And that was all worked out by the computer as well, because as technology evolved, we went away from using pagers to smartphones. And these smartphones, you would log in with your own PIN number. Now, that PIN number then tells the computer what your skill set is. Then the computer would automatically tell the dispatcher he's qualified for that straight away.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
So, I mean, it was a system that was developed by a company called Forcom. So they sort of developed these smartphones with that sort of software on to aid us in what we do. Yeah. And it was quite clever because as well as the app could actually load up Google Maps and it would actually take us straight to the address.
Right.
And when we arrive at that person's address, we just used to press one button and that was arrive at scene. And then it would tell control room that we're there.
Right. Mm, okay. Cool.
I mean, just Forcom just, sounds like something that you might have in a Carry On Laughing film, doesn't it, really? That
it does. I mean, like I say, it went from, like, using old school pages that, like, you know, bricks, to using the latest tech. And it's still evolving for the emergency services technology side, because there's always other things in the pipeline. I mean, they're talking about something called the Emergency Service Network, which is using more smartphone technology and using broadband, in stepping away from using like 2G, 3G sort of systems and going to like 4G, 5G realms of technology. So it's always evolving. It's always evolving.
Did you think at any point AI will have an involvement in that?
Possibly, but I think we could be still a long way from it.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. Yeah, that's fair enough, dude. So what was the thinking then in terms of childbirth? Obviously, road traffic accidents, I get. You probably want the ambulance folks there first. And I guess you guys turn up, secure the scene, make sure everything's okay. And I guess, you know, with childbirth, I'd have thought there'd be some comforting to be done, maybe. I don't know.
You would have thought there'd been a level of support, maybe, that you know, if they are experiencing difficulties, because obviously, you know, all the advice is that, you know, if the ladies experience contractions, then take it to A&E and this, that, and the other. But I suppose if they're experiencing difficulties, just thought there'd have been a level of, well, we'll get a first responder there. Even as you said, Adam, even sort of the figurative arm around the shoulder, a bit of comfort sort of thing. That was a bit.
Yeah, I think it's because also there's too many complications that can go wrong. To be fair, and normally they would rather send a two-man crew than a one, because technically I worked on my own when I did that.
Right. In terms of the skills then that you had and you learned through those two courses, if you had a scale of 1 to 100 and you had somebody you absolutely nothing about first aid was 1, someone like me that's done a couple of first aid courses for coaching or through work or whatever is maybe a 5 or 6, and your top notch paramedic is 100, where would you sit after doing that first and then that second course?
Ooh, probably a 7 or an 8.
Really, so it's way, in that case, I'm going to revise mine to a 0.5. Because if you've done 400 tests and the 12-week course, I can't say I'm a 4 or 5, and then you say you're a 7. So, there's a massive gulf between the paramedic.
There were certain things, like I say, we didn't deal with, and I suppose for obvious reasons, and I think as well, looking back, you sort of understand those reasons as to why. But I think if they had gone that further, probably I'd say even higher than 7.
Oh, you don't need to go into the gory details. I don't think we need those. It wouldn't be fair.
We do.
but what was the worst sort of things then that you had to deal with?
Oh, well, in my time, I probably dealt with quite a few cardiac arrests where I've had to literally get a defibrillator and resuscitate oxygen, putting OP airways in to secure an airway.
Yeah.
And I think probably in the 14 years, I think probably resuscitated about 20 people, and probably 4 or 5 of them have made a recovery.
Right.
So
you just said that, would you intubate then? Is that what you, so in terms of sort of...
I don't really intubate as such. I put what they call plastic tube in.
Right.
So it keeps the tongue in one place.
Ah, right.
So then you can put the oxygen on.
Okay.
So, The paramedics normally tend to intubate, and they use a thing called a bougie tube, which is huge, and it literally goes in and down into your lungs.
Yeah.
So that's more of a skill than anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to know what you're doing with that. You have to use stethoscopes and stuff like that, because you have to hear that the lung, it's near the lungs, and you have to make sure that it's in the right place. So it's more of a complicated thing, really.
In terms of that then, dude, so you're talking about, you know, that's a lot of pressure to put on a person, that you are there trying to resuscitate, trying to bring someone back from the jaws of death. How do you cope with that mentally, just out of interest?
To be honest, sometimes certain jobs always sort of stick with you, usually the worst ones. But sometimes some of them also, you can become a little bit, without being bad about it, a bit desensitized.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can be so used to dealing with certain things. I mean, crazy thing is, I didn't mind dealing with like blood and stuff like that. The only thing I couldn't stand is vomit. It's like, just no. So there's certain things like that. But yeah, I think you do become desensitized after a while.
I wouldn't cope well with that kind of stuff. I had a solid 15-minute retching session the other day, just cleaning out the filter in the dishwasher.
Yeah, you're not great, are you, with that?
No, I'm not. I am super, super squeamish. Yeah. So when you say you got a little bit desensitized then, dude, is there that sort of gallows humour that you folks have then when you're dealing with this kind of thing?
I think the other way of looking at it is we become a bit more, I wouldn't say gallows humour too much, but I would say it's a case of, you know, we try and be a little bit more dignified as well, you know, because sometimes as well I've come to scenes where relatives are there and stuff like that, and it's like,
yeah,
okay, yeah, you know, you've got to wear your professional hat. Definitely.
And with that as well then, dude, so when we're asking there as well, I asked a little earlier how you cope with stuff, I presume then that the first response unit or what have you have something in place just to make sure that you guys are okay and are
definitely
dealing
with it. You know, at the time there was always somebody there at the end of a phone, you could always say, yeah, this is what's happened.
Yeah.
Before you know it, you know, it's there, whatever you need is there.
Did you have to do like an advanced driving course? You don't have blue lights or anything like that, do you?
No. So we didn't have to do any of that, luckily enough. And there were a few groups that did do it.
Is that because you're a terrible driver?
Yeah, I'm not. No, I don't know really. I don't think I was a terrible driver, to be fair. But no, there were a few groups that did the advanced stuff. Like Nantwich, they had a group that did because most of them were firemen. Okay. So they were like part-time firemen, and yet they did that as well. And yet they did the because they already did the fire service work, they already had the qualifications to drive around on blue lights. So one group in particular was Nantwich. So they were allowed to do it. So, you know, there was the odd one or two like that. And the odd one or two in Cumbria were as well, because, again, most of them were either mountain rescue or firemen. So, yeah.
One of the things I was going to ask was, you know, go back a few years and there was quite a lot of sort of negative press around sort of gangs and groups of young lads, ambulances and this, that and the other. Have you ever had any sort of negative experiences about sort of turning up to maybe a scene or turning up to a house and you've been the recipient of either sort of abuse? And obviously I don't want you to, you know, mention any specifics as such, but, you know, where you were perhaps subjected to, you know, it, sort of vitriol or sort of abuse or anything like that?
Yeah, sometimes we went to the odd one or two where there was a little bit of things like that. For example, I had one once where I parked outside someone's house and they didn't like it. And they were like, oh, you can't park there, you can't park there. It's like, well, I am, because I'm dealing with an emergency. So yeah. I need to deal with that emergency. And there was this like, knocking on the door then every 10 minutes, can you move your car? And I was like, well, no, I can't, I'm sorry.
Was that in the house that you were actually dealing with? Was it somebody else? Yeah. Was it like next door?
Yeah, it was like a neighbour.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's mad, isn't it? You think that, you know, you're there to help, you're there to support, you're there to effectively, as Adam said earlier, you know, potentially save somebody's life, yet you get somebody else going, can you move your car? It's a bit of an obstruction. And you're like, you've got to be there for a reason, obviously. And surely they must realise that you're there for a reason. So, you know, you thought that logic would dictate, but I suppose you can't help some people maybe. But it's just curious, you know, obviously you hear stories of, I mean, sort of fire brigade and ambulance and police and that, and you know, they're getting attacked.
It's
by going to certain places. Like, really?
I must admit it, when I first started back in 2007, there wasn't much of that going on.
Right.
But over the years, it's attacks on crews and stuff like that has gradually got worse. When I used to be a solo crew, sometimes, you know, my backup could be, you know, anything between 5 minutes and an hour away. And sometimes you're sort of like, right, you know, you have that thing in the back of your mind where it's like, okay, I'm on my own. I've got to make, you know, I've got to keep an eye on myself.
Yeah.
Watch my surroundings, what's going on around me, who's around me, et cetera, et cetera.
And have you, and has that happened to you quite a lot where you've felt you've got a sense of service, I suppose, in terms of responding to the call, but actually in the back of your mind, you've got your own personal safety to consider.
And very much so.
And again, without any specifics, has there been a time where, and I don't know whether you even can you decline a call, or can you go to a call and then can you call it in and say, I don't feel safe doing this, therefore I'm going to remove myself?
Yeah, I can do that. And I have done that once where I've gone, I don't like this situation. I'm going to retreat to the car and wait for the necessary backup to come and deal with that.
Right.
So there is
that must be an awful sort of quandary as such, you know, being a trained first responder, you're thinking, I suppose your natural instinct is I've got to go and I've got to try and help that person. But then contrary to that, you're thinking I've got to look after my own personal safety.
Yeah, pretty much. It's one of those where it's like fight or flight in some ways.
Yeah.
And also sometimes as well is that you got to think of other members of the public as well that might be around. You know, is their safety in danger? You know, do I have to keep them out the way? So, you know, as well as your own, you've got to think of everybody else that's around you. And that's why you've sort of always got to be aware of your surroundings and what's going on.
I've got a question, dude. Are you talking about there's a very selfless element to what you do. And as I said earlier, don't get me wrong, I have respect for all human life and society and everything like that. But why do you feel a compulsion to help people? To what you said it earlier, it's about you wanted to find a way to contribute. Where do you think that comes from?
I mean, I look at it and I trace it back to partly family roots, because I had an auntie who was a nurse at Chester, and she made her way up to ward manager. My mum was an auxiliary nurse, and my grandma was also a nurse. So I think, you know, some of it is sort of embedded into, you know, what previous family have done. And the odd one out was an uncle. He was a fireman, so, you know. And it was quite funny because occasionally I did bump into him on certain jobs and work alongside him, so it was quite funny.
Yeah. I'm quite cool. Oh, what are you doing here? What are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what are you doing here? Yeah.
So is it completely voluntary then?
Yeah, it's completely voluntary. I mean, we had to do, when you did the enhanced course like I did, you had to literally do a minimum of about 18 hours worth of duty time a month. So in a way, it was like being like a special constable.
Right.
In a way, because they have to do 20 hours. So we had to do 18, but sometimes I ended up doing a lot more, you know. I ended up doing nearly 30, 40-odd hours a month. Yeah, I even used to do Christmas Day and Boxing Day as well sometimes, just to plug the gaps.
So would you go out with paramedics then? Would that be part of your training, or is that just something completely separate?
I was trained on where all their equipment was on their vehicles. So if they said to me, go back to our vehicle, grab this.
Right,
grab it,
okay.
I knew exactly where it would be.
Yeah.
But the only time I'll travel with them is if we had a severely ill patient and it needed two people in the back and a driver.
Okay.
So that's the only time I would have essentially gone with them.
Right.
And leave my vehicle behind and go back for it later.
Right. It was just, you know, more in terms of going through your training, and particularly when you mentioned earlier that you were going on the slightly more advanced one, and you had to do more hours. It was whether or not that incorporated actually some time with paramedics going in the ambulance, and maybe you weren't necessarily hands-on at that point, but actually just experiencing what they experience.
Yeah, we did have to do what we call two compulsory shifts with them a year.
Okay.
So we had to actually go out with them and see what they did. And sometimes even get our hands dirty as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, we had to go out with them. But, it wasn't just them we worked with. I mean, I had the opportunity a few times to work when I needed the air ambulance, for example, and called them out to jobs. to back me up, because say for instance a patient was in the middle of a field, for example, I shut down Manchester Airport for half an hour. That was my tale to fame.
And claim to fame. Woo!
Claim to fame. I wasn't very popular for that. Had somebody have an accident in a field. I can't go into too much detail.
Yeah.
But the field happened to be next to Manchester Airport.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, we can't get the vehicles across these fields because it's too muddy and they'll get stuck. So I ended up calling out the helicopter. And the helicopter had to cross both runways at Manchester Airport.
So wow.
I literally shut down Manchester Airport.
Good work, dude.
I remember the pilot, who was ex-army pilot. And he said, I hope we're not going to be too long here because my headset is screaming with pilots at the airport going, how long have we got to sit here on the tarmac for? We've got loads of holiday makers that want to go.
I can just imagine like Northwest Tonight, first responder responsible for Manchester Airport delays. You know, Stuart's like, that was me.
So, yeah. Brilliant. It was quite funny, that one. I was like, oops, did I just do that?
Just imagine the tourists, they sit at the pub, whatever it's called, at the airport, whatever. Oh, we're going to watch all these planes come down. It's like, oh, shit, there's no planes. Oh, that's you again, is it? There he is. He shut it down again.
It was quite funny because it was like, there's Jet 2, there's EasyJet, you know, there's Ryanair, all just stacked along the taxiway, yeah, just waiting. And his helicopter's brilliant. Like, the helicopter pilot's like, we've really got to get a shifty on now.
Yeah, if you're going to die, this is going to die. If you're going to die quickly. We've got some holiday making back in the terminal. Need to get gone.
That's it. See, we laugh now. We would probably sat there in the terminal. Why are we going?
Albert's asked the question, do you not get paid, which you just kind of covered because it's totally voluntary. But do you get like any expenses or anything like that?
We don't get paid, no. And the only expenses we got really is if we had to travel to a course, really. That was it.
Right. Wow. So, I mean, it's mad to think it is complete, because I this is going to sound really naive.
Yeah.
I was under the assumption that first responders was a paid position. Now I get the fact that it's not a paramedic and it might not be, you know, hugely, so you know, lots of money and big wages and salaries and stuff. But I didn't realise that actually it was nothing.
I'm surprised.
No, really surprised. I'm really naive about that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I used to go to, when I used to get to jobs, I used to get people saying to me, so you must be on good money. And when I turned around and went, no, I don't get paid. And they used to look at me and go, what?
Yeah.
You know, and that was people I got sent to, was always saying, bet you're on good money. No, I don't get paid for this.
So how many shifts as such, or how many nights or, you know, days in a month would you be effectively on call? Is it like a one night a week? Is it like a five nights a week?
Yeah, I mean, usually it'd be like one. We used to have like our own shift pattern. So it used to be like 8 in the morning was till like 1 in the afternoon, and then 1 in the afternoon till 6, and then 6 till 10 at night.
And is that like once a week or twice a week? Or?
Yeah. That's normally just once a week.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Fair play to you, dude.
Unless you're like me, I used to try and squeeze in 2 or 3 a week. You know.
Well, I take my hat off to you for that, mate. Because the fact that you do that, you give it your time up for free.
Yeah.
And fair play to you, dude. It's not even like it's an easy way, I'm going to say, to earn your money, but it's not an easy way. It's not an easy shift. Yeah.
And you've got, you know, for everybody that's gone through, I mean, you probably will have done it in your job, and Dave will have done it in his, and I've done it in mine. You know, you go through the first aid courses, and you know, you go through your 3-day advanced first aid and your paediatric. Mm. You know, I work in school, so you know, I have paediatric first aid and this, that, and the other. And you think, and even when in that situation in education, where you think, okay, you're probably just going to get bumps and bruises and stuff. Whenever you get called for first aid, there is that little bit of like, oh. Bit like what's happened?
Yeah,
you know, so that must be hugely ramped up. You know, for mine, really, as Dave pointed out, like the 0.5 on the scale sort of thing. You know, to be faced with something like, Christ, I actually genuinely don't, because ultimately, I suppose your responders are only they're only as good as the information that they're given. So if somebody on the scene is saying shortness of breath or whatever, you know, the dispatcher will go, shortness of breath, we're gonna dispatch Stuart. You get there and it's like he's got half a limb hanging off, he's got like this, that, and the other, and you're thinking, shit, you know, like, you know, they didn't put that information forward. So, you know, there must be that, I suppose, adrenaline, and that's where you know, your training really does kick in. You know, your adrenaline's going, you get to your senior, right, the training's kicked in now.
Yeah, I mean, it does when we used to have like a call color coordinated category list. So we used to get purple. Purple was like dead,
right?
Pretty much.
Okay.
So if I saw that come up on my screen, my ears pricked up, and I'm thinking, I've got about 4 to 8 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
And then there's red, which is life-threatening, or, well, immediate life-threatening. So you've got about 8 minutes. Then you've got amber, which is severe, but not immediate. And you have normally about 20 minutes. And then you have, like, green, and they're, like, you know, an hour to 2 hours. So they're like somebody that's fallen at home that just needs picking up off the floor. You know, that's how they, you know, categorize what it is. So the more severe it is.
But that must only be graded on the information. So if somebody dials 999 and say somebody's fallen, well, and I assume that you know, the dispatchers, without knowing, would go to that flow chart. Well, are they breathing? Are they this? Are they that? And they would then categorize that, and then that would be sent to you. But based on that information, that could be slightly inaccurate, which means that you arrive to see that maybe you're thinking it's amber and actually it's a red or white or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And that can happen, and that has happened a few times over the years. So it does happen. But, yeah, when they put all this information into the computer, it grades it as what it thinks it is, but it might not be.
Yeah.
And again, that's barely down to the information that's given by the call taker.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you handle a purple when you're sitting in the car and you've got to drive, you know, through a town, or, you know, you've got to drive 3-4 miles, you've got a purple and you haven't got lights, and presumably equally you're not allowed to speed. What would you do? I mean, are you allowed to flash your lights to get cars out of the way? Are you allowed to
I have to literally drive normally. Luckily, I knew some of the shortcuts, so I knew roads that would shorten the time down in certain areas, which is really handy. But my mindset was, when I was going to purples, for example, was, right, I need this piece of equipment out the back of the vehicle. I need this equipment. I need to do this. I need to get this piece of equipment ready. You know, I'm going to need a defibrillator. I'm going to have to get the oxygen ready. So all them sort of things, when you're going to those sorts of jobs, sort of play on your mind of what you're going to need before you even get there.
You see, I find that in a way incredible that, as a first responder, you might be responding to a purple call, which means that basically death is imminent and you've got to get there within 4 to 8 minutes. And you're not allowed to jump a red light. You're not allowed to speed. You're not allowed to flash or whatever. And now I would have made an assumption that, and I'm not saying that you can just do carte blanche, but if you have evidence or you've got proof to say, I'm on a call, I've been dispatched to this guy's going to die if I don't get there. If you jump the odd red light, or you jump, you know, if you're driving it, I don't know, 45 or 15 or 30 or whatever it may be, that there isn't some leniency for that, because you're going to save somebody's life. Do you know what I mean?
And like you just said, you know, over the years there has been accidents where emergency vehicles in general have been going to jobs and they've either hit somebody at a crossing or they've hit another car. So for that reason, they thought, well, these guys are volunteers. We don't want to give that extra responsibility like that to them.
Yeah. I get it, and I can see that the liabilities, I suppose, if you then hit somebody on a call or on a response to a call, then this, you know, I get it. It just doesn't quite sit with me that you're asked to do a service to people and to save somebody's life, but then you're not then given, I suppose, every opportunity to get to them in a way that would save their life.
Yeah, it does seem a bit ridiculous. But, you know, I think they didn't want to put any more extra sort of onus on us than what we already were doing.
And I get that. I suppose if they said that you could speed, you know, all of a sudden you're driving at 60 through a 30 to try and get there, and then that means that you might not be in control of your car, you might drive dangerously, you might endanger other people. So I get it. It just rankles with me a bit that you're there to try and save somebody's life, yet you can't get there as quick as you potentially could, if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. And sometimes as well is, you know, the idea of the whole community responder scheme was originally set up just so that the scheme would just cover like a town or a village or something like, you know, that really, not like a big city or something.
Yeah.
And somewhere where you could be able to get from A to B in a reasonable, you know, in a reasonable time, but in a safe manner.
Yeah.
I agree with you though, guys. It's difficult. And to be honest, I've learned a lot about just the position itself tonight.
Yeah.
So you no longer do that job anymore. So what is it that you do now then, dude?
Well, now I look after the Merseyside and Cheshire Blood Bikers. So we look after like the whole Cheshire, Wirral and Liverpool. So I actually am a dispatcher. Roles reversed from being a responder on the front line, and now a back office computer person that answers the phones, talks to the hospitals, looks and sees what motorbikes are in the area that are able to pick up blood samples and take them to wherever they need to get to, or human breast milk for premature babies at like Alder Hey and places like that.
Yeah.
Those people, those blood bike dispatchers, are they paid or volunteers? I'm just wondering.
No, again, we're all volunteers. The riders are all volunteers as well.
Wow.
And we're quite lucky, really. We've got 8 motorbikes that look after the whole of Cheshire and the Wirral and Liverpool. So, yeah, we deal with quite a lot of different hospitals. You know, I think there must be at least 30, 40 we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And are those bikes, you know, you see, and you'll have to excuse my ignorance, and I'm dramatising it, and I don't mean to be, but you see on TV where it says, like, we need some particular blood type going from where we need to locate a particular blood type, and it might be that we've got to move it from Alder Hey, Liverpool to Manchester or wherever because they haven't got any. Is that you? So in terms of, is it just like routine blood dispatch, or is it actually
We can actually do that, but we don't do it as much because the NHS Blood Service have got their own blue lighted cars that can do that. So normally during daytime hours, they actually manage quite well, and they're based out at Speak. That's where they're based. But at night time, if they really were struggling, then we'd get the call. But we did quite a lot of stuff. We did taking COVID samples, for example, from hospitals and nursing homes and stuff, and taking them to a laboratory in Oxford originally, because they were the only ones that, at the time of COVID when it all started, that had the equipment to be able to test for it. So we were sending riders back and to from the northwest area, going down to Oxford, just delivering these samples for testing. And now we've got quite a few labs in Cheshire and Liverpool that can actually do it themselves now. So we don't have to go to Oxford anymore, luckily.
So I go to my local doctors in Alsager, and they say, right, you've got to have a blood test or whatever. They take a blood sample. And they say, oh, that's got to go off and be tested for whatever it is that's being tested. Is that you? Do you then collect that? Or is that something different?
If it's done at a doctor's surgery or like a community hospital, then, you know, they either send it through the NHS courier if they've got one, or if it was like a really urgent sample that needed to be tested, they could call upon us to do it. Other things we get is tissue matching.
Right.
So we get some of that. And sometimes we get other blood bike groups asking for our help, like Wales. You know, they've phoned us up and gone, oh, we've got one of our bikes traveling from Bangor and he's going to meet you. Can we send him to meet one of your guys in Chester? And then take it to the specimen sample lab over in Liverpool for us. So, yeah, we get jobs like that as well. So we don't just help out our own area, we help out others. Yeah.
And it's like most things, when you drill down to it, you don't understand the scale of it. But, you know, the logistics of getting, you know, we've got, a tiny little doctor's, it's probably not tiny, you know, serves all stages. It's a reasonably decent town now. But, you know, so when you extrapolate that, I think each town has a doctor surgery that will be taking multiple bloods to, I'm assuming, multiple labs. And I think ours maybe goes to Leighton, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, so you think that there has to be a facility to transport that. They then process the results, and then obviously the blood doesn't come back, but the results will. But the initial logistics of getting that blood sample to that hospital or that lab or whatever is quite significant. And you drill down to it, Christ, the amount of people on a daily basis that will be having blood tests across the Northwest. You think, Christ, there's a lot of blood flying around all over the place. You know what I mean?
It's not just that as well. I mean, it's certain samples have to go to certain hospitals. So, like, for example, cancer patients, you know, some of their stuff will go to places like the Christie, places like that, because it's something that they can look for, you know, in the blood sample. You know, is there this in it? Is there that in it? And they can actually assess it better because they're sort of geared up for looking for that.
Do you think that the voluntary nature of it is important and critical for the way it works, rather than if it was embedded in the NHS, it wouldn't have the flexibility and the resources?
No, I don't think it would have the flexibility or the resources. And that's sort of been proven, because normally blood bank groups like mine that I'm a part of, we normally save the NHS about £1 million a year in transportation costs.
Right.
That's a lot. So that's £1 million that the NHS have got to, you know, extra to spend a year. If they didn't have a service like what we provided, I could see samples being put in taxis and being driven by taxis, and taxis charging £50, £60, £70 a trip.
So excuse my ignorance then. And you've said you potentially might save the NHS £1 million. And it, where did you get funded from then? I know it's a voluntary service, but you've obviously got costs. You've got, you know, you'll have maintenance costs, you've got fuel costs and all that. So where do you get your funding from?
Mainly general public organisations like the Rotary, the Lions, Masons.
Oh, really? Wow. So it's effectively private voluntary groups that raise money for you, as opposed to local authorities or local councils or anything like that.
Yeah, very much so.
Jesus,
this is blowing my mind.
I'd never even. Yeah,
I. You know, we think of ourselves as a. We call ourselves a first world country, and we get, like, you know, our NHS is a fabulous institution, and it's the envy of many places in the world, as well it should be.
Absolutely, amen to that.
But, you know, there's things like this that blow my mind. I had in my mind was a part of it. I understood that surely it must be funded, and that funding is going to be challenged. It's going to be, you know, needs to be driven down. But the idea that it's relying on people giving up their own free time, using their own vehicles in some cases, I find it absolutely mind-blowing.
And going to local organisations like your Lions, like your Rotary Club, like your Round Table,
it's crazy.
Almost capping and saying, can you raise money for us because we're providing the service? It's staggering, actually.
It is.
in a bad way.
It is.
In a really bad way. I can't get my head around it, dude.
No, it is crazy. And I think, if you look at all, there's loads of voluntary organisations out there. And I think, you know, I think certain things like the NHS and certain emergency service organisations and stuff like that would be a bit stuffed without volunteers. You have a look at, like, all the other organisations out there that have volunteers, like the RNLI, Mountain Rescue, Cave Rescue. You have, like, organisations like Cheshire Search and Rescue and First Responders. You know, you have all these organisations that are out there that they're all volunteers, and they all have to go, you know, asking, well, not always asking, but asking for funding from somewhere. And, you know, I look at it as though we're all one big emergency service family. And I look at it as though if these organisations didn't exist, you know, I think some well, quite a lot of people's lives we wouldn't have been able to save.
It's weird because the RNLI, growing up, the RNLI used to get people to say, "We're raising money for the RNLI," and I get that. And now I think about it a bit more, that's a tragedy as well. But I get that. But I never associated first responders in that category of voluntary, effectively relying on contributions from community-based projects, etc., etc. I just always assumed that it would be NHS funded.
I guess though that there's I look at this as two ways. All of these the organisations that Stuart's just listed, and they're just the ones that help people in danger. There's, you know, I volunteer at a football club. All the people at the football club, there's 20 odd 25 teams, all of us are volunteers, the committee and all the coaches. So it's not just the sort of health medical type volunteers, it's across the country, and all the people do these things, and that's what living in this country or any country is, everyone doing their bit, which makes the whole better. But then the flip side is, if you tried to put these services within the NHS, it would probably just fail because it would be absorbed, it'd be cost cut, you wouldn't have the resources when you need it. When you're volunteering, I guess there's flexibility, and I guess it can scale up and down a lot easier than if it was part of the NHS. You'd have people not working all the time because they didn't need, so they cut it. And then when you need it, it wouldn't be there. So I think it fills a role that way as well.
That's happened as well, where there's certain NHS, like mental hospitals, for example, there's the odd one or two of them that have closed down. And because they've closed down, what happens? You end up with limited bed numbers for these people to go to. So it becomes another problem.
It becomes a burden elsewhere. So you close one down, it becomes a burden. And it's that ongoing. And Adam mentioned it a couple of minutes ago, you know, God bless the NHS. It's a phenomenal institution, and it's been around for, you know, for years and years and years and years. I was going to say hundreds and hundreds, but it's maybe 100 odd, a couple of hundred maybe. Yeah. But, and it is the envy of lots and lots and lots of even first world countries, you know, the nature of the NHS. But you think, and Dave makes a really good point, ultimately it would come down to, I suppose, if it's paid, it comes down to economics, and it would come down to, well, actually that's not sustainable in that capacity, so therefore we're just going to bin it off, whereas the voluntary aspect of it might keep it going.
And the definitely, you know, the voluntary side of things would keep things, certain organizations, going. But again, sometimes it can be tricky to get volunteers for organizations these days, you know, because with the way things are and the way that the economy is, people seem to be working a lot more and don't tend to have that extra 2 or 3 hours here there to volunteer for these organizations, you know.
But it's strange because, you know, and I'm not disparaging anybody that volunteers for clubs and societies, and, you know, I know Dave volunteers and helps to support football in the community and does a phenomenal job and an amazing job. It's slightly different than potentially responding and saving somebody's life. And there's a difference in my mind. There's a difference between, you know, giving a little bit back to the community in terms of, well, I'll go and coach some kids cricket, or I'll go and run a football club, and that's not being disparaging to anybody that does that, because they do a fantastic job and they do a fantastic service and they provide for the local community. But that to me is very, very different than being in a position where you're responding to a purple call and actually you've got 4 minutes to get there, otherwise that person's dead. Do you know what I mean? And that's not belittling anybody that volunteers to
do anything. I'm
struggling with that.
Yeah, me too. And just so the NHS has been around for 75 years.
Or 75.
75 years.
Founded by Clement Attlee. It was his principles behind it. And Dave, obviously, you and I did politics, so we are very familiar with Clement Attlee.
We are, but according to Wikipedia, the founder was Aneurin Bevan.
Well, yeah, he was the guy, but Clement Attlee was the guy.
He
was the prime minister. Let's give him. Yeah, he wasn't just.
What year was that?
He was the one that put his seal on it.
He was the guy. He didn't just say, Dave, he didn't just say leave it alone, it works, about the House of Lords. That's about all I remember him for when we did my contributions to my politics A level were reflected in my results. So Stuart, well, we got you on here as well. You commented on our holidays episode as well. So you're planning a trip to New York as well, aren't you, dude? So there we go. Guys has got his New York T-shirt on tonight.
Hey.
You weren't a big fan of Times Square. I did. I'm with you on this one. But tell us about your holiday there, because I saw some of your pics on Facebook. Looked like you had a fantastic time. Tell us about one of your plans. Come on.
I'd love to go back at some point soon, back to there and visit it, and obviously get to go to places that I couldn't have seen at the time, you know, because I went only for a week, and you can't really sort of cram everything, because there's too much to see there, into a week. So if I did go back, I'd probably, you know, like to go and visit the massive aircraft carrier that's a museum there. And a few other museums, like the zoo, I'd like to visit as well, in Central Park, maybe. That'd be worth a visit. And the famous Ghostbusters fire station place. I didn't get to do that, and I'd love to do that.
It's strange, because when you do New York and everybody says, like, go for 3 or 4 nights and that's perfect, it's a city break. But when you go, you think, you look at the list of attractions when you do your city pass or whatever.
There's just hundreds.
Like 8 or 10 or whatever. And there's like pages and pages. And you're like, God, how do you pick like 8 out of them? And I'm not saying you would go for a week or 2 weeks, because that would just be full on. And, well, it costs you a budget fortune because America's expensive. But, you know, but you think, Christ, how do you pick out of all of them? You know, when we wanted to do the High Line, and we never got to it because we were just doing other things. And when we go back, like Jenny, like my wife, was like, I really want to do the High Line, walk the High Line and stuff. And we never did. And that's one thing that we would definitely do. Yeah. But as you just said, Stuart, you know, I'm a bit of a geek and a bit of a Ghostbusters fan. You know, I'd love to do that.
Definitely.
You know, my two daughters are friends. They love Friends. So we did the Friends experience, the Friends apartment and all of that.
Yeah.
But there's so many other things that you think, Christ, I'd love to. I mean, I'd love to go back here. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there, and it's brilliant. But there are so many things to do. And you go up, you know, some people go, they go, right, we're going to go up the Empire State. And then you don't want to be doing that. You want to be going up One World Center or The Rock or whatever, you know.
I did both of those when I went. I went to the One World Center and went to the Empire State as well. And loved them both. It was great. You know, absolutely great. But yeah, I do like New York, and I definitely.
I'd like to go back. And the girls said they'd like to go back, but we'd like to maybe do another couple of. I'd love to go to Washington. I've never been to Washington. I'd love to do Chi-Town. I'd love to go to Chicago and stuff. So America is on the cards at some point, but not exactly sure when.
I do also fancy maybe some point, maybe San Fran, maybe.
I've done San Fran.
You have.
I love San Francisco for years, just reading the odd book here or there. And there was an author years ago that I used to read a lot of, and he set his books in San Francisco. So I'd always got this thing about, I wanted to go to Fisherman's Wharf, and I wanted to go to Union Square and obviously Alcatraz and stuff. And I was fortunate a couple of years ago. Now we basically did New York, Las Vegas, San Francisco, and we did like 3 or 4 nights in each sort of thing. And I loved San Francisco. You know what? There is a big bit of a homeless issue there. And we didn't see loads of it, but you read the literature and they do say there is a big homeless issue. But you know what? You just be careful where you go and stuff. Like most big cities, be careful where you go. But we had such a good time. Although, I know America is expensive. San Francisco is fudging expensive, because not only have you got tipping, but you've also got your state tax. So you've got your California state tax on top. So you pay for your meal, you pay for your tip, and then you pay a state tax. And it's like, geez.
Yeah, you don't have that in New York, do you? The state tax.
No, you don't have the state tax. But obviously in California, you do. So you go there and it's like an extra, is it like 10, 11, 12%, whatever. So you're thinking, oh, you know.
That must have something Arnie introduced.
Yeah, I'll, where is he? I'll fight him. No, maybe not.
Yeah, I'll be back.
So just quickly then, before you let you know, go, we mentioned at the start, you're very, very good for watching our episodes and commenting on them. So just out of interest, Stuart, yeah, I know you watched the Flat Earth episode that myself and David did when we were joined by Sam from Australia. What did you make of that episode, just out of interest?
Well, I think each to their own, definitely. And I think that, you know, maybe some of the stuff he said is right. Who knows? Who knows? It's one of them mysteries. I like to keep an open mind on things like that.
It was really interesting because I wasn't on that episode, and I would have loved to have been on it. And I messaged Adam and sort of said, "How did it go? What did you think?" And he went, "It was challenging. Intellectually, in a way, you know, he came with various facts and figures and stats and evidence and
yeah,
quite prepared. But, you know, ultimately, well, it is a globe and we know that. But, you know, Adam did say it was quite challenging, and it was very much like
it wasn't what we expected.
Yeah.
You only believe the rhetoric if you trust the people. You only trust the rhetoric if you trust the people that are telling the rhetoric. And I suppose that's the message, that you only trust what a politician says if you trust a politician. And if you don't trust what the people that are giving you the information, how do you trust the information they're giving? And I understand that, but ultimately it's a globe and it's been proven it's a globe. But scientifically it's been proven it's a globe. But to be fair, you know, you did say it was
interesting.
It was interesting and challenging, wasn't it?
Really interesting.
I mean, I had to throw in the conspiracy question to see what response that would trigger. Because sometimes, you know, you get all these conspiracy or groups, don't you? Like the Illuminati and stuff like that. And they're sort of like, how can I put it? They sort of like put these ideas out there, don't they? Via means and ways to make you think this is actually, you know, this is actually what the planet's really like, or, you know, they sort of conspiracy.
And I think there's a little bit of, not preying on the weak-minded, that's unfair, but certain people are susceptible to certain points of view, and if you can persuade people, and more people, certain people are open to the conspiracy theory than others. So if you can convince them, then, you know, and some people are more susceptible to that type of thought process, I suppose. So
and you know, there's loads of conspiracies about everything, isn't there? I mean, you look at it and you think, oh, conspiracy theory on ghosts, you know, or conspiracy theory on UFOs. This is actually
we've done podcasts on them.
And we'll do more.
And we'll do more. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I like, sort of looked up and sometimes read, is the conspiracy theory of the Rendlesham Forest mystery back in the 80s, you know, with the so-called black triangles and stuff like that that people have reported up and down the country, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm one of those ones where I believe it when I see it.
Well, maybe we'll do an episode on that, and maybe we'll get you back on to talk about it and get your opinion on it. What do you think?
I think that might be a goer.
We'll plan that one in for 2024. No, around about the hour mark, which is, as you well know, the time that we like to wrap things up. So first of all, Stuart, I have to say thank you very much, because this has been a really eye-opening episode for me. I have learned stuff that I didn't expect to learn, and I had an idea going into this, how it all worked, and I am amazed. Well, I shouldn't be that amazed to learn that I'm wrong, because I'm wrong frequently, but I am absolutely amazed to find out how it actually works, dude. It's blown my mind a little bit.
Yeah, no, I sort of concur. I echo what Adam said. I had a preconceived notion of what I thought it looked like and what I thought happened, and to find that's just completely almost flipped 180 is like, mind blowing, really. But I'll just say thank you, Stuart, and I know you contribute on previous podcasts and comments and views and stuff. So please continue to do that. Can't wait till we have you on again, and potentially we can talk about black triangles and conspiracy theories. I love the sound of that. I'm a massive conspiracy theorist, if that makes sense. Oh, but look forward to the next time.
Indeed, definitely. Dave. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, it's been great. to have you on, Stuart, and learn about what you do. And when Adam said we'll pencil in for 2024, he wasn't like kicking the can down the road. It's just that we've got every episode booked up to the end of the year. So it did sound a bit like, yeah, we'd love to have you on. How about 2024?
Yeah, how about next year? Well, genuinely, it will be next year.
But yeah.
And like I say, I like the program and everything and the work that you guys do on there. And I'll occasionally put the occasional comment in the question box.
Look forward to it.
Definitely.
Indeed. So much appreciated. Like Dave said, we are planned up to the end of 2024. Next week,
which is amazing because we hardly plan anything. So to the fact that we've planned like 3 months in advance, hey.
Listen, we're out tomorrow night.
That's crazy. I've
completely forgotten about it. So, yeah, in all seriousness, so next week we're back. We're talking to a guy who does beer reviews. So nice. We know you like beer on here. So this is the beers I've had tonight, 241 and number 242. And I thought, because you're on, Stuart, I was drinking beers from Stuart Brewery, which are the people who made the Stone Cold Stunner beer, which I have to say, we
lambasted. Nice.
It wasn't.
the label looked fantastic, but the taste was absolutely putrid.
Yeah, it was. And I've tried a couple more of their beers. I thought we panned them last time. So I thought the fairest thing I could do is give them another go. And they're pretty bad as well.
To be fair, you did crack a beer open halfway through.
I think, to
drink it, I was like, oh, okay.
It's very rare.
I think one for you to all try, maybe the Tappan Brewery one, you know, the blonde one.
That the blonde one is
good. Yeah, Tappan Brewery's.
Their Viper is my favourite. Yeah, they do the Viper. Mm. And actually, funnily enough, we tried to get the head brewer on from Tatton, who, by the way, no longer works for him. He's gone to work for Buxton Brewery.
Really? Oh, just while we're on about breweries, a little bit of a shout out to Wychwood Breweries. They're sort of no more. Oh, well, soon to be no more. Or maybe no more now.
They've called it a day.
A little bit of a shame, that.
Yeah, so we're getting ahead of ourselves. We started next week's episode already.
We have. Wrap it up, dude.
So, yeah. So, did you want to say your goodbyes to our listeners?
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on your program. And thank you, listeners.
Indeed, indeed. David?
Goodbye, folks. Thanks for listening. Stuart, appreciate it. Good one.
Indeed, indeed. And next week, Dave might even have his microphone sorted. Gazza.
Goodbye to here. Goodbye to the world. Look forward to next time.
Indeed, indeed. So, yeah, thank you very much, Stuart. I really, really have enjoyed this episode. Like I said, we've learned a lot. And hopefully the people out there have listened to this episode, taken a lot from it, learn a little bit more about what you do, appreciate a little bit more about the people who give up their time and put in the effort into keeping this country ticking over. Maybe, just maybe, the next time somebody rattles a tin in front of you and it's got the Lions Club written on it or the Rotary Club written on it, you might just put a couple of quid in there just to hopefully keep these things ticking over. And with that thought, I will leave you to join us again next week where we will be talking about something, like we said, entirely different.